Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Susan Sweeney Crum. Coming up a little later in the show, WFPL Stephanie Sanders talks with author Bruce Feiler about his journeys to Israel, Iraq, and Iran. First, though, you've seen the photos, such as President and First Lady Reagan waving out of the hospital window, or presidential candidate Al Gore kissing his wife at the 2000 Democratic Convention. But there are also the photos you haven't seen of Madeleine Albright at the end of a tough day, or Muhammad Ali in his prime. All of these photos, both public and private, were taken by photojournalist Diana Walker. WFPL's Robin Fisher spoke with the Fraser International History Museum's Casey Carrico about the exhibit, Diana Walker, Photojournalist.
As much as I'd like to talk just in general about the museum, today what I'd really like to talk about is the Diana Walker exhibit, and I think it's called Diana Walker, Photojournalist.
It is. It's Diana Walker Photojournalism is an exhibition that we open in December. It closes March 4th, and it's on loan from the Smithsonian.
Can you tell me who is Diana Walker?
She has a photojournalist that worked with Time magazine for about 25 years, and her main, topic when working with Time is to cover the past five American presidents.
From what I recall from the exhibit, she was the White House photographer for Time from Ford through Clinton.
Mm-hmm. And she not only was part of the press pool and took a lot of public images, but she was also allowed behind-the-scenes moments of the George H.W. Bush and the Clinton administrations.
And she was not the official White House photographer.
No, not at all. And she wasn't the president's personal photographer either. She was always representing Time magazine.
And what do you consider photojournalism?
Photojournalism, I always say, really sums up the catchphrase, a picture's worth a thousand words. You know, journalists write extensive articles on topics, and photojournalists really have that one moment, that one frame, to really capture the entire news story. That's their mission, I think.
The exhibit is broken down thematically into several sections, mm-hmm. and you walk in and you turn to the right, and mm-hmm. there's your first picture of, I think it's George H.W. Bush, mm-hmm. is right there on the right. But it really focuses on the public versus private moments. I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about that.
It does. It takes a really interesting perspective. Although it is broken down thematically, you'll notice as you go through the exhibition that about half of the photographs are in color and about half are in black and white. And the color images are the public moments, those moments where there might have been many other photographers. They're moments that covered, things ranging from large campaign moments to, the signing of peace treaties. And then the black and white images cover the private moments, those where Diana Walker may have been one of only two photographers there, just her and the president's personal photographer. And these are really more about the man, not so much about the office of the president. You see a lot more emotion, a lot more of the trying pictures.
Well, I have to agree with you. I thought it was really striking seeing the pictures of George H.W. Bush and when he was on the campaign and everything, and he's with his family, and it's mm-hmm. a huge family.
Well, and I find that to be a great thing about photojournalism. In a day and age where there's 24-hour news coverage and you can, get on the Internet and see anything, it was amazing to me to see how many images from Diana Walker resonated. And when you think about George H.W. Bush, one of the first things, if I had to name five things about him, would be he was a family man. And in these images, I think, really show that. And you have to ask yourself, well, why do I think he's a family man? Because the photojournalist showed me that image.
And by contrast, Ronald Reagan's focus was always Nancy.
Mm-hmm. It was.
And I thought that was really interesting. It's always the two of them.
Mm-hmm. Always as a pair. And one thing I found interesting in reading through the exhibition catalog, Diana Walker has a lot of quotes and talks about the ease of working with different presidents and their strengths. And she said Ronald and Nancy were great in front of the camera because they specifically knew how to work together and they really had that chemistry. It wasn't just on the camera. It was off the camera as well.
One thing that I thought was interesting in reading the labels for the photographs was Diana Walker talking about how she had to be invisible mm-hmm. and at times even up on a ladder hovering mm-hmm. over the president while he was at his desk.
And you have to think of how hard it would be as someone working. You always hear the term a fly on the wall, and that's literally what she had to be. And it would be hard to be yourself, but then, there's several images in the exhibition that are of her. A picture of President Reagan working at his desk, and she's literally above him as though she's suspended from the ceiling, it almost looks like. And you have to think how hard it would be, but she was there so often it just became natural. like she was part of the family and part of the furniture.
Well, there's one picture that is of President Clinton, and he is backstage at a debate. Mm-hmm. And you can tell that they're poring over the questions in, you know, preparation for this debate.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone else is looking this way and that way. They're pulling their hair. They're stressed out. He has both hands on his face, and he is looking directly at that camera.
Mm-hmm. And you wonder what he's thinking looking at her. Is he looking for help? Is he looking at her frustration? He really captures the moment of what it must be like. And those are images that we so often don't see. We see the prepared presidential candidates at the debate. We don't see all the agony they go through in researching and finding their point of view and the way to present that to the public.
One of the sections in the exhibit is Clinton's last week,
mm-hmm.
which was also Diana Walker's last week.
It was. She retired from full-time work with Time magazine the day that the current president was inaugurated. And that's my favorite part of the exhibition, because you not only see the emotions that President Clinton and his family felt, you can see on their face what it must be like to, you know, lead a country for 4 years and leave the post, and it's about them walking around the White House and saying goodbye to different staff members. But I think you can also see Diane Walker's personal journey of letting go, because it's almost as though he's passing through a threshold, passing along the presidency, but she's passing through a threshold going into her retirement. So I think it really resonates in the photograph.
And there are pictures of her with the Clintons.
Mm-hmm, there are as well.
Yeah, the one picture of Clinton, Bill Clinton leaving office. There are also pictures of Senator Clinton, Hillary Clinton, and Chelsea.
Mm-hmm.
But the picture of President Clinton in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
Saying goodbye to the kitchen staff and eating at the same time.
Well, again, you know, if you had to name five things about President Clinton, one of them would have to be, you know, his love of junk food that you saw parodied in many places. And you have to ask yourself again, why do we get that image? And largely, I think it's due to photojournalism.
Talk to us a little bit about the section of the photographs that are not presidential.
There are a couple of sections, one being Diana Walker's favorite photographs, and those are just personal photographs that she loved. A lot of them are portraits of Muhammad Ali, Jamie Lee Curtis, Katharine Graham, those types of things. There's also a section called Tracking Business and Politics that deals with Madeleine Albright and Steve Jobs. So those are in there to really show the breadth of Diana Walker's work. You know, so much of her work dealt with the White House, but it's really to show that she was a very well-rounded photojournalist.
One of my favorite photographs in the exhibit is a picture of Madeleine Albright. Mm-hmm. It's at the end of the day. She's sitting there. She's slumped in her chair. Her skirt is riding up. She's all frumpy and hunched over. And you just see her there as she described herself as that high school girl,
mm-hmm.
you know, that never fit in. And there she is. She's exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that just captured the whole feeling of who she is, who Madeleine Albright is, and just Diana Walker's work.
You can really see her character. And I think that's a theme through Diana Walker's work as well, is the character of the people, not the posed picture. And the great thing about the public versus private moments is often in the exhibition you can see the posed picture directly beside the more personal picture, and you can really see the two viewpoints of someone.
What are your favorite photos?
Two in particular that I really enjoy actually go together. One deals with the Clinton family, and it's entitled Clinton Family Portrait. And it's not a posed picture. It is one of the personal moments. But, you know, it's all three of the Clintons, and it's mainly cropped to their faces. And it's just a nice photograph. But when you go into the section on the White House, there's another photograph of Clinton and all of his staff in the Oval Office. And it's shot from the point of view of sitting behind the desk. So in the very foreground of the picture, you see all the frames that he is sitting on his desk. And in the very center frame is that portrait that Diana Walker took. So I think it shows how important she was in their lives, that of, you know, maybe the seven frames on President Clinton's desk, the center one is a portrait that she took of his family.
Now, when people think of the Fraser International Historical Museum or International History Museum, they don't always think of photographs.
Mm-hmm.
So how does this exhibit fit in with the mission for the museum?
One of the things we're really looking to do is show that history isn't just what you learn in the history books, and history isn't just what we have in our permanent collection. We cover about 1,000 years going from 1066 and the Battle of Hastings all the way through President Roosevelt. But history doesn't stop there. And we're really trying to show that history comes all the way up to today, and it's relevant to what's going on today, what's going on tomorrow, and we're always making history. So by showing photographs, which is a media you see more used in this day and age, not so much back in the time period we cover, we're really trying to show a little bit of the history that maybe we were alive for, some of the things that will really become relevant to each person who comes to see the exhibition.
Casey, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much. It was good to be here.
That was WFPL's Robin Fisher talking about the career of photojournalist Diana Walker. The Diana Walker Photojournalist exhibit is at the Fraser International History Museum through March 4th. When we come back, WFPL Stephanie Sanders talks religion with Bruce Feiler, the author of the book Where God Was Born. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Susan Sweeney Crum. Coming up a little later in the show, WUOL's Daniel Gillum interviews renowned composers John Corigliano and Joan Tower. First, WFPL Stephanie Sanders talks with New York Times bestselling author Bruce Feiler about his latest book, Where God Was Born. Feiler's previous books include Walking the Bible, which also became an award-winning series on PBS, and Abraham, a book about the shared ancestor of Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. In his latest book, Feiler travels to Israel, Iraq, and Iran in search of a way to combat today's violence that is done in the name of religion. He spoke with Sanders about his journey in his own Jewish faith and some answers he found in some of the world's most hostile territories.
The question that I had running through my head the entire time I was reading Where God Was Born was about your Bible. I wish I had counted how many times the sentence, I pulled out my Bible, or we pulled out our Bibles, appeared in the book. And you address this a little bit at the end of the book, but what does your Bible look like after all these travels?
It certainly has upturned corners and kind of dust from many deserts all over it. I can't say it has blood off the top of my head, but I like the fact that it kind of gets beaten. I mean, I have to say, it's funny. Your question reminds me. It's been, as you know, 10 years now that I've been making these journeys, retracing the Bible through the deserts of the Middle East. First with Walking the Bible, in which we went up Mount Ararat, crossed the Red Sea, and found the burning bush, and retraced Moses' path through the desert. Then with Abraham, my journey looking for the shared ancestor of Jews, Christians, and Muslims. And now with Where God Was Born, as you said, I go through Israel, looking at David and Solomon, into Iraq in the middle of the war, and into Iran to look at the roots of the Bible in ancient Persia. And after all of these years, when people say, like, the Bible to me, or people mention the Bible, a book is not actually what comes to mind anymore. It really is a map. I really think that part of the problem that we have with the Bible is that it does have those kind of black covers and those gilt-edged pages. And, of course, it wasn't published in that form. It was a series of scrolls, if anything, and they were really never even gathered together for most of their history. But for me, it really is a great adventure story, and I see this map of the ancient Near East and the Fertile Crescent and people kind of wandering from place to place. So one of the things that I try to do when I talk about the Bible is to sort of say it is contemporary. You can crawl inside it. You can kind of move into it, as I have the last decade. And then that kind of somehow softens the great authority that the Bible, capital B,
right,
seems to have for many of us.
Well, that's a great segue to the next thing I wanted to ask you about. A little more than 100 pages into the book, you say, I had to find my own route to God. I had to tear down the icons I once blindly accepted, go back to the source, and construct a new religious identity. Do you think this is a path that everyone who is raised in a certain religion should take to some extent?
Well, I think yes, is the short answer to that question. I think if you look at contemporary society today, we all are our own historians. We are our own journalists, even. We no longer accept what our parents tell us or our teachers tell us or our journalists. As a writer, I hate to say that, but our journalists tell us. We get on the Internet. We do our own research. We go to study groups. We talk to our friends. We live in this time and this place, a kind of, you know, YouTube world, where each of us makes up our own ideas about what we believe in. And I think that religion is perhaps the last major endeavor of the human life in which that's really happening. And I think it's scary to a lot of people because it's much easier to go to a church or a synagogue and have someone kind of tell you these are the 7 things you need to do to get your kid into college, or these are the 8 things you need to do to have a healthy marriage. But the truth is, ultimately, I think it's more fulfilling. I think we saw that with the Da Vinci Code. I mean, I've traveled around the country. I've probably given 250 talks in the last 5 years, and I've been in a lot of religious institutions, and a lot of them have a little piece of paper tacked up to the door saying, come on Tuesday night to discuss the Da Vinci Code.
Right.
Now, I'm sure most of those religious leaders didn't think that they wanted to hold a special session on Tuesday night to discuss whether the church systematically, deliberately covered up the role of women in the church, but they have to because the people are demanding it. And I think that's what's happened to me in a small way. I think that both I'm an example of this and the beneficiary of this, that with all of my books, Walking the Bible, Abraham, Now Where God Was Born, we're seeing people reading them, again, trying to make up their own relationship with God, but then ultimately finding that they want to talk about the work with other people. So then they sit down in a group at their bookstore or library, PTA, and talk about it. So once we break away, we find that we kind of reinstitutionalize ourselves or reform into groups in order to talk about what we believe in.
Right. I mean, I can definitely identify with that. I mean, I am by no means a biblical scholar, but I was raised and am a Christian, and I can relate to that need to rediscover the Bible, and especially identified with your wife Linda in Where God Was Born when she reread Esther and realized the story wasn't quite like the version she was taught at a young age. I really, you know, when that happened in the book, I thought, oh, that's been me a billion times.
Well, yeah, she actually, as you recall, I took her, basically what happened was, for those of you who haven't read the book, I went to Iraq in the middle of the war and went to the Garden of Eden and to the birthplace of Abraham and to by the rivers of Babylon. And then having left my wife at home for this trip to Iraq, I decided to make it up to her by taking her on a second honeymoon to Iran. And she's like, gee, a honeymoon in the axis of evil.
Yeah, thanks, sweetie.
In fact, I was recently offered the chance to go to North Korea, and I came home and said, hey, guess what, I can go to North Korea. And she's like, well, why do you want to do that? And I said, well, I can be the only one you know who's been to all three countries in the axis of evil. And she's like, that's a really long way to go for a punchline.
Exactly.
Anyway, so, but back to your question, I think that we think of the Bible in a lot of ways as being black and white, those stories that we learn about when we're young. And somehow that's off-putting in a way. But I think that what's fascinating about re-encountering the Bible as an adult, it's like George Washington, guess what? He didn't not chop down the cherry tree, and that's okay. Like, it's gray, and I think that these stories are gray, and rather than being frustrating, to me that makes them much, much more interesting to kind of encounter them. And I think that that, to me, is the great sort of opportunity of our time. And you know, a lot of times I'm asked, why do you think these books have touched people in the way that they have? And obviously I'm not the best person to answer that question, but one thing does come up in what people write me on my website and say to me when I talk is that, you know, most people who speak about religion do so from a position of certitude, either because they have it or because they feel they should adopt it. But most of us out there in the pews, or frankly in the pickup trucks, because we're not in the pews, we have doubt. And I think that the hardest thing for me in Where God Was Born was to write about my own struggles and also those of my wife. But ultimately, that's the thing that people most respond to. Thank you for talking openly about your doubt. That's, I think, what's missing from the conversation with religion today, and that's what most of us experience.
Right. I mean, kind of going along with that kind of inner conflict that you went through that I certainly identified with, I certainly felt that way when I was reading about David. There are pages devoted to describing him as tyrannical and deceptive and lustful. And I by no means ever thought that David was perfect, but it was hard for me to reconcile that image of him with the David who is a man after God's own heart. And you had that same inner conflict, right?
Well, I think that, you know, I remember the first time I ever went to Israel a decade ago and went to Jerusalem, which is such a beautiful city up in the hills. It's got this incredible incandescent light, kind of the pink sky that fills the air every afternoon. And someone said to me, welcome to the city of David. And David, of course, conquers Jerusalem, and it's a kind of a highlight of the biblical story. But then, as you said, I mean, he's already at that point being a terrorist. He terrorizes his own people. He's a traitor. He fights with the Philistines against the Israelites. Then when he gets to town, you said lustful. He sleeps with Bathsheba, kills her husband, fights a civil war with his son. And the interesting thing is that the climax of the story, David turns to God and says, you know what, you've been living in a tent since the time of Moses back in the desert. What do you say I build you a proper home? I build you a temple. And God says to David, well, well, no, you're not going to do that. You're not worthy. You stick to politics, which is fine for corrupt people like me, but you leave the values of the people to me, that religion, morality in many ways, is much too important to be entrusted to politicians. And to me, this message is very surprising. I mean, it gets to the point, let's not forget, that God is so upset with the behavior of the Israelites that he yanks them off the land and sends them off to exile back in Babylon. And what God says here is that land is not the most important thing. Even having a state is not the most important thing. The most important thing is having values and having a relationship with me, with God. And that is the message of the Bible, and it is lost. And I think that in some ways what God is saying to us is that the heroes are not the most important thing. I've been writing and reading a lot about Moses recently, and even he, the greatest hero, arguably, of the Bible, is punished by God in the end and doesn't get to the promised land. And you would think that that is just a devastating blow, and yet it's another message that fulfilling your own dreams is not necessarily the goal. It's having a relationship with God. So I think that that is the message of the Bible, and it's an unexpected message, but I think it's a message that really resonates today.
But at the same time, even with David and Moses and even Abraham, doesn't it say a lot about God that he doesn't expect perfection out of the people that he chooses to carry out his mission on earth?
Well, I'd go one step even further, and I would say that God himself is not perfect. And again, we think of the Bible as being this book about God, but God is also shows vengeance and shows violence. And remember, when the book of Jonah, as you know, in the book, I go to Iraq and go to Nineveh on the border with Iraq and Turkey, and God asks Jonah to go to be his personal emissary and to go tell the Ninevites that he's going to destroy them. Jonah flees, runs, gets swallowed by the whale, is there for 3 days, it becomes very important to Christianity later, is then reborn, goes back to Nineveh, and by the time he gets there, the Ninevites have said, you know what, we like God after all. And Jonah gets all huffy and goes, sulks under the tree, and God turns on his own prophet and turned in favor of the people whom he'd earlier had appeared to reject. And I think that, to me, after all these years, 10 years now, first with Walking the Bible, both the book, the TV show, I mean, so much of my life has been spent in this area. Now with Where God Was Born, I go back to what is my favorite line in the text, and that's in Genesis 1, when God says, "Let us create humans in our image after our likeness." And what that says to me is that each of us carries a little bit of divinity around within us. So to disrespect another human is to disrespect God. And insofar as sometimes humans show deceit or lack of faith or bad behavior and that struggle within humans, if humans are made in God's image, which of course is, again, the thesis statement of the entire book, then that suggests that God has these values as well. And to me, that is the story of the Bible. It's the story of God and humans trying to figure out, each of them, their own frailties and develop a relationship with one another.
Several times in Where God Was Born, you visit the issue of morality. On page 317, you say, even those who believe in other gods can still, by acting morally, be part of God's world. And then on page 375, say, God embraces any people who share his moral vision, no matter their identity. And while morality is certainly important, I think many Christians and probably Muslims as well, and even most religions, would disagree, don't you?
Well, I think that what we're talking about here is two different things. We're and this has been the theme of my work for the last many years, which is a difference between what the Bible says and what the religions say the Bible says. But to first of all address the text, I think that the Bible cannot be read as endorsing the idea that one group of people has an exclusive claim to truth, because time and again it says the opposite. You are reading when you're talking about my book, when I was in Persia, when I was in Iran with my wife, as you mentioned earlier in our conversation, we went to Persepolis. Persepolis is one of the great sites of the Holy World, and it was built in honor of Cyrus, who went to Babylon in the 520s BCE, destroyed the city, ended the exile of the Israelites, and told them they could go back to Jerusalem and rebuild their temple. In fact, he would pay to rebuild their temple. And you go back and you look at history, and Cyrus is definitely a vastly important and under-discussed human figure, because he had the biggest empire of the time and told each of the colonies underneath it that they could worship their own god. Cyrus introduced the notion of pluralism. And in the Bible, in Isaiah 45, you'll see it says, "Thus said the Lord to Cyrus, his anointed one, the Lord God calls you by name." Anointed in Hebrew is Mashiach. In English, it's the Messiah. Cyrus is the only non-Israelite who earns this distinction. And I think it's the Bible's way of saying that God will respect people who are different, even as long as they embrace God. And I do agree with you that Christianity, at least certain divisions of Christianity or denominations of Christianity, have stressed something different, but that doesn't change the fact that the Bible shows a tugging, a kind of tension between those who want God to be exclusive to one group and those who want God to be universal. And I think that the universal God actually wins out, and I think that certain denominations of Christianity have, for their own purposes, undermined, and by the way, Jews do this well, and of course later Muslims do it also. It's just a kind of tendency of religion to say our interpretation is the only interpretation. But I don't think that that's really a full reading of the Bible, and that's why we have lots of division. I mean, the whole Eastern Orthodox Church views the Bible in a very different way than does the Western Church, and of course Protestants view the Bible differently from Catholics. So we have, even within Christianity, vastly different ways of looking at the story.
What about, because the thing that struck me, especially in that first part that I read, that said even those who believe in other gods can still, by acting morally, be part of God's world. The thing that just was maybe a dagger in my heart when I read that was the first commandment: you'll have no other gods before me. I mean, that seems to be in direct opposition to that.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because to me that is such a proof. That's such a proof text that actually supports my case. And if we take the way you just repeated the line, "There shall be no other God before me," first of all, we have to say that acknowledges that there are other gods. It doesn't say there is no other God. It says, "Thou shalt have no other God before me." But it also specifically does not say that the other gods must come after me. If anything, I think that's a way of acknowledging that the Bible does not tell a story that there's kind of one God and everybody worships that God and always has since the time of Abraham. If anything, it shows a kind of rising and falling of the faith of the people in God, and you can see that in many places in the text. As we said, we were talking about David earlier, the great hero of the text, and his name is mentioned more than any besides Moses, and yet at times he switches God rather openly. So I think that the Bible describes a time and a place which the God of the Israelites is in dialogue and in tension with the other gods. And it's long before, of course, the Hebrew Bible is what we're talking about here. It's only until the very end, even that something approximating Judaism gets invented when they're in Babylon. Christianity, of course, is several hundred years in the future, even from the end of the Hebrew Bible. Islam is 600 years, even further in the future from that. So this is one of the sources of power of the Bible is that it comes before the religions that grew out of it. And sometimes we can go behind those religions and find a story that the religions haven't necessarily promoted. And that's not even to go to kind of where we are in a kind of post-Da Vinci Code world, where people have come to understand since the Dead Sea Scrolls that there are other gospels, that there are other stories, that there are other versions of these events, which are not even in the Bible, that in fact the Bible is not the only version of the story that it tells. So I think the kind of summation of all of this is that the Bible is a very powerful document. I've devoted 10 years of my life to reading it and traveling in its footsteps, and I love it in a very, very real way. But I don't believe that that the Bible is the only source of truth out there, and that we have to be in conversation with the dialogue. We have to be in conversation with the Bible, just as the God in the Bible is in conversation with different religious leaders.
When discussing the Tower of Babel, you say God separated the people through language because he was insistent upon diversity. Do you think this insistence on diversity has been the crux of our world problems for all these years? And if so, does that mean God set us on this path?
Well, I think that that's a very fascinatingly phrased question. I think that I would have to say I look at the story somewhat differently. One of the joys of retracing the Bible through the desert has been sometimes being in the places themselves has changed my interpretation of the story, and the Tower of Babel, I would say, is kind of foremost among them. That before going, I looked at it as this punishment, right? The humans were building the tower. God was threatened by their unity and dispersed them all as kind of a punishment, and as you said, gave them all different languages so they couldn't talk to one another. I actually have come to view it differently in Iraq, all over Iraq, including Ur, including Babylon, including Nineveh, including Nimrod. You see these ziggurats, and a ziggurat is a pyramid, a stepped pyramid that was built at the time so that they could get closer to the god of the moon. And it's very clear that the Bible appropriates this image for the Tower of Babel. And as they're building this tower, and I think the text says quite clearly that God didn't like the fact that the humans were all working together. He then comes the moment he wants to punish them. Well, what does he do? He could kill them. I mean, God kills them plenty of other places in the Bible. He could have drowned them. He could have made them all mute. I mean, any number of punishments that he does, in many cases, in one place or another in the story. What is his response? His response is to disperse them all over the world and give them each a different language. Rather than being, I think, the curse, I think that this is God's blessing. This is God's wish for us. He wants us to be diverse. He wants us to speak to him in different languages. He wants us, in a way, to figure out how to relate to one another. Now, it's true we haven't necessarily done that well all through history, but I do think, to me, it is the call of God. He wants there to be diversity. To me, it actually is a direct response to the fundamentalist claim that there's only one way of speaking to God. If there were only one way of speaking to God, why would God have given us different languages? He is telling us in that act, from my point of view, that very clearly there are different ways of developing a relationship with the divine.
The overwhelming theme of the book is interfaith dialogue and its use as a tool to overcome today's violence that is done in the name of religion. And early on in the book, you ask Yusuf Natcha if he thinks voices of hate are drowning out voices of moderation. And he says yes, but he still has hope. And then later, in your conclusion, you say that you're convicted that the only force strong enough to take on religious extremism is religious moderation, and that religion can only be saved by religion. After being in all of these war zones, do you think we're even close to that?
Thank you very much for having me on. let me say this. I think that we look at this problem, through eyes that are not exactly reading what's really going on. I think that we often we've come to believe that there's a dichotomy in the world between religious extremism and secularism. And if you look at almost anybody who's looked at studies of religions in the world, and that includes in this country, University of Akron does a study every 4 years about religion in America, and their most recent one showed that the percentage of Americans who were agnostic or atheist was 11.9%, and the percentage of evangelical fundamentalist Christians, which this study identified as the religious right, were 12.6%. That leaves the vast majority, three-quarters of Americans in the middle. Those are people who want a relationship with God and yet who struggle to kind of figure out, they believe in respect and tolerance, but they're trying to kind of work out where to draw the lines in their lives. And I think, to me, kind of the call of where God was born is for those of us in the middle to kind of speak out and join the conversation. I do not believe that the kind of secular left, if you will, are going to be strong enough to respond to the religious extremists in the world today. I think that's what I mean by religion can only be saved by religion. Those of us who believe, who struggle to have a relationship with God in our lives, but who believe in respecting others, we have to kind of seize back the conversation and say, well, we're the majority, and we want to stand up to you and say, wait a minute, you cannot claim that there's only one group speaks for God. To me, the greatest weapon in that battle is the Bible, as we've been talking about here, that the Bible cannot be read as endorsing the idea that one group of people has an exclusive claim to truth, because time and again it says the opposite. So when the extremists hold up Scripture and say it says this, those of us in the middle, we can stand up and say, well, wait a minute, it also says this. So yes, I believe that this is the call of the hour. I think that There are days when I think it's going well and days when I don't think it's going well. But I think one of the problems is that we all grew up, we have to get over that thing our mamas all told us, which is don't talk about politics and religion in public. Well, guess what? The extremists do. Those of us who believe in respect, we have to, and tolerance, we have to speak out as well. So that, to me, is the call, which is, you know, we have to join in conversation and say this is our Bible as well. We have to, in effect, take back the Bible. And that's really what I'm saying here and where God was born. If you're worried about these tensions or values in this country or your own relationship with God, come on this journey with me because I think you'll be changed. I think you'll be surprised on occasion, but ultimately I do think you'll find a path of hope.
All right, great. Bruce Weiler, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was WFPL's Stephanie Sanders speaking with Bruce Weiler. His latest book, Where God Was Born, is now available in paperback. Filer will be in Louisville this week for an interfaith discussion and book signing. The interfaith discussion starts Tuesday evening at 7 at the Cathedral of the Assumption on 5th Street. The book signing will follow. Although there is no charge for the event, line numbers for the book signing are available at Carmichael's bookstores. More information is available at our website. Go to WFPL.org and click on Studio 619 under Select a Program. When we come back, Classical 90.5's Daniel Gillum interviews two Grawemeyer Award winners for music composition. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Susan Sweeney Crum. Joan Tower and John Corigliano are among the most performed American composers alive today. Joan Tower won the University of Louisville Grawemeyer Award in 1990. Corigliano won the Grawemeyer in 1991 and the Pulitzer Prize in 2001. Daniel Gillum of our sister station, Classical 90.5, recently spoke with Corigliano and Tower about their lives, works, and winning the Grawemeyer.
Would you give us a brief synopsis of your Grawemeyer Award-winning First Symphony?
In the 1980s, the late 80s, AIDS was killing lots and lots of people and lots of my friends. I stopped counting after 100 friends died than I knew. And it was this thing that the world was going on and people were going to work and television was doing and all of this was happening, and yet I was visiting people in hospitals and going to memorial services all the time. And I was the composer in residence with the Chicago Symphony under Schulte, the great years of the Chicago Symphony.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my jobs was to write a major work for them. And I had a very dear friend from college days who was a pianist, lived in Chicago, but also had an apartment in New York, which is where I met him. He was a fantastic pianist, very funny guy, and very dear friend, and also a very talented composer. And he had played with the Chicago Symphony many times and other orchestras. And when I came to Chicago, I thought, well, this is great. I have a really close friend who lives here. And within the first season that I got to Chicago, he started getting sick and finally went to the doctor and was diagnosed with AIDS. And at that time, that was a death sentence. And I was about to start a piece for the Chicago Symphony, and Schulte asked me to write a concerto for orchestra because he had done my clarinet concerto and my tournaments, and he thought I wrote virtuosically for the orchestra and to write him a big virtuoso concerto for the orchestra. And I had mixed feelings about it. I would have done it because it was such a great orchestra then. But I wasn't sold on it. And when Shelley got sick, I realized why I wasn't sold on it, because it wasn't addressing, you know, the issues that I was living with every day, which was all my friends are dying. And so I realized that I needed to write a piece about that. And I'd always shied away from writing a symphony because I thought, well, in this day and age, we don't need any new symphonies. The repertoire is full, and it's just an ego trip now for a guy to write a symphony.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said I'd never write one. I've now written three. But anyway, and I thought at that time, well, yes, this is a symphony. It has to be that scope, because the scope of this tragedy is so vast. And then I went to see the management, Henry Fogel, and I asked him about writing a symphony about my friends dying of AIDS. And he said, of course, we'll back you up on that. And started writing the piece, and Sheldon was alive. And while I was writing it in New York, I would call him in Chicago, and he would do very funny imitations of James Levine, you know, Horowitz and all the things he did,
mm-hmm.
Because he was very much in denial. He was taking AZT, he was feeling good, and I certainly wasn't going to discuss the fact that, you know, he was dying.
Mm-hmm.
So I was writing the piece, and in fact the first movement specifically about him, and talking to him on the phone, joking, and then putting the phone down and writing this as a memorial piece. So, in a sense, basically, it was a very, very difficult time for me.
Sure.
I mean, extremely difficult. And I did that and wrote the whole piece, and he got sicker and sicker. And what happened was Schulte at that time, who was conducting the Chicago Symphony, but at that time, the summer that I sent him the full score of the symphony, that summer I was watching television and I saw von Karajan had died, and I saw Schulte getting on this plane and going off to Salzburg. And I knew at that time, I said, well, there goes him performing my symphony, because Schulte was a very slow learner. He really took a lot of time to learn things, and I knew he wouldn't have the time to do it. And sure enough, I saw him that fall, and he came up to me and said, my dear, I don't have any time to learn a new piece now, because my summers were the time that I did it, and now I must go to Salzburg. And that was really upsetting to me, because I thought he was a tremendously great conductor. But what ended up happening is, therefore, Baron Boyne did it in the world premiere.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, Shelley was close to death, and he was very ill, but he went to the rehearsals, and it was extremely touching because the members of the orchestra didn't know who this old man was, who was sitting in the back, who, you know, looked like 100 years old, and then they realized it was Sheldon, and they stopped playing, and they ran over and embraced him, because they'd known him, and they, you know, he was less than 50 years old, but he looked 100.
Hmm.
And then he went to the concerts and the performances, and I dedicated the work to him, and he loved that, and a week later he died. And the symphony, I think, made him happy because, you know, he so much wanted to be remembered, and he certainly deserved to be. And that was certainly something I wanted, too. So it's a symphony about, you know, remembrance. It's a symphony about all sorts of things, and it does reflect my views on friends and remembrance and, you know, loss and anger and all of that.
You've had quite a bit of performances throughout your lifetime by every major orchestra, I guess, in the U.S. and around the world. What have been some of the highlights so far of your career?
Well, you have to include the chamber music world there. Because I came out of a chamber music background,
right.
Having played piano and founded the Coppel Chamber Players. And I've dealt with a lot of very good chamber groups, the Emerson Quartet, the Tokyo Quartet, Kallstein Laredo Trio, and others. And that's been extraordinary series of experiences. We're traveling in that world, which is very different from the orchestra world,
mm-hmm.
because they have much more time.
Mm-hmm. Well, in some ways, do you think it's more beneficial when you're writing for a chamber ensemble? In the long run, I guess.
Definitely, because of the simple fact that you have more time,
mm-hmm.
and you can talk to them directly and make changes, and there's less pressure on the page. With the orchestra, you've got the week mm-hmm. that they learn the piece in, and you can make very minor cosmetic changes,
mm-hmm.
but mostly you can't. So there's a lot of burden on the page to come out exactly the way you wanted it.
Well, and you've been fortunate to have repeat performances of your orchestral works where, you know, many composers may only hear it once, and that's it. So you certainly have that to say also.
Well, the Made in America project,
mm-hmm.
which involves 65 orchestras in 50 states,
yeah,
that was extraordinary on so many levels because I got to make changes over the first few months mm-hmm. of the piece. And my publisher would go running around making the changes, and then I'd conduct the changes at the next. I conducted 8 of the orchestras,
mm-hmm.
And it was a growing experience with the piece.
Mm-hmm.
And it also gave me a chance to really get inside the piece, what was working and what was not working, from a live, repeated performance level. I made 2 choices that I'm proud of. One is I tried to imagine that this was being played by every level of orchestra you can imagine. So I had several instrumental advisors look at the piece and say, that's too high
mm-hmm.
for the section,
mm-hmm.
or that's too fast for the winds, or something,
mm-hmm.
because I had never really dealt with community orchestras before. So I was kind of struggling with what they could play.
Mm-hmm.
So I brought in a wind player, a brass player, a string player, and they gave me some fantastic advice to pare it down so that everybody could play it.
Mm-hmm.
The second choice I made that was the best choice I made was I was imagining this work being traveling around this vast country of ours, and I said, now what is it that everybody knows? And I found America the Beautiful, which is a tune that everybody knows.
Sure.
Everybody knows that tune. And it's a tune that I love. And having been brought up in South America, there's a whole story there. I thought, this is a wonderful way, a tribute to this country by embedding that tune in this piece. So that was a good choice.
That was Daniel Gillen talking with Grawemeyer winners Joan Tower and John Corigliano. You can hear the entire interview with John Corigliano and his first symphony tonight on Brave New World with Daniel Gillen on our sister station, Classical 90.5 WUOL. That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information about today's show, go to WFPL.org and click on Studio 619. You can email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can also write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. Or you can reach us by phone at 814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by the Public Radio Partnership. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at PRP, including WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. Alice Thompson provides website direction. I'm Susan Sweeney Crum. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.